Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello.
And Benroy Turner.
It's getting hot in here.
It's getting hot in here, but leave on all your clothes for now for the next half hour or so, because we just thought we'd have a big old discussion on the state of games as it is, but also the relationship to the way that things were across the 2000s. Now, this comes from all three of us looking at the trailer for X Defiant, the new Tom Clancy game. Just you've got to refer to it like that. I don't know if it's not really a full-on...
No, I'm not. Sure, I'm not doing it. I'm playing Tom Clancy games right now, the Splinter Cell games, the original trilogy. I'm not calling it a Tom Clancy game straight away.
You did just finish Pandora Tomorrow as well. So how does it feel for you watching the X Defiant trailer?
I'm just like, I get there's probably a thing on a chart that goes, if we say Tom Clancy, it will probably make 10 more grand that we can buy some nice socks with. But at the same time, just if you're not going to use it properly, then just get out. I didn't know Tom personally, but he probably would have just thrown up on himself if he'd seen what that was.
I think it's a hell of a departure. It's a bit of a weird one, but we kind of just used that. And when me and Josh did the news video on it, the sort of reaction type thing on it, we sort of used that as a jumping off point and just sort of saying, like, have games passed us by as slightly older people? People who have these reference points for the 90s, for the 2000s, is this just what the hotness looks like now? Is this just what all the teenagers are into? The sort of the hip-hop happening people? Is this just what games are going forward? And that sort of wider question of, which has been doing the rounds for a little bit, on whether or not the 2000s were actually a golden age, and we're just kind of on the other side of this this peak that we managed to hit, and now we're on the other side of it. So there was a poll during the rounds last year, which I managed to find again, which is from manyspins.com. Where they surveyed 1,700 gamers around the world, and 40% of people said that the 2000s were the golden age of gaming, with 4% saying the 70s, so just couldn't get enough of Pong back in the day. But still, going to extend the question out, though, as a general talking point. Do you guys agree or disagree with that general sentiment that the 2000s were a golden age of gaming?
It's such a big question. What's it is, right?
It's kind of the biggest question.
You know what? I'm going to say, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to go from 2005 to like 2015, like somewhere in the middle there, probably for me. I think that there's a lot of innovation and stuff that I really enjoy from like 2010s and like how animation just got there. Like I think it's the people I'm trying to include the time when The Last of Us came out and kind of changed my life as a progressing human going into the world of working. But I think it's definitely got merit of being, there's definitely reasons for it coming out and being that time, that sort of time. Mass Effect came out then, BioShock, so many other games that I can't list off right now. I think Kane and Lynch came out that time, so you just got to rack up all the big hitters. But I'm going to diverge to Josh, and I want Josh to now whack down this point and say probably Kane and Lynch wasn't that good.
Kane and Lynch 2 is definitely not good. Kane and Lynch 1, it's all right. It's fine. It's okay. Oh. I got that for my birthday 1 year.
That's the heat talking. That's the scintillating heat talking.
Just wait till you hear what I have to say about Resident Evil 4 and Wii. That's maybe the best version. Who knows? What was I going to say? When we were talking about this question, when I look at, you know, my personal favorite games of all time, the games that I always go back to, the games that I replay from a personal level, almost all of those came out after 2010, which was a surprise to me. You know, so I have so many games after that period that I just absolutely love. And I don't think it's a recency bias thing because, you know, some of them came out in 2010 and I still love them now. Fallout New Vegas, for instance, my favorite game ever. That said, I think, you know, towards the end of the 90s and into the early 2000s, I think you just saw this like seismic shift in kind of like what games were, that kind of established what games were going to be for the next decade or so. You know, I feel like it's hard to pinpoint one specific golden age because, you know, video games are so relatively new compared to every other medium that I think we're always constantly innovating. And while we might not be going at the speed that we were, you know, when the boom actually first happened, I still think we're going along at a breakneck kind of like pace in a lot of ways, and things are constantly changing, things are constantly upgrading. But I think if you look at sort of, you know, the end of the 90s, where you started getting like, you know, Metal Gear Solid was ushering in cinematic storytelling, you had Resident Evil, you know, popularizing like survival horror, all that stuff, you know, the jump to 3D, 3D being solidified, I think, you know, there was so much going on in that era. But I honestly don't think you can fault whatever anyone chooses, because there's always so much going on, always so many good games coming out. And I guess that's what we're going to pick apart today.
I have an idea. I was just going to jump off Josh's point. I have an idea. Like, they kind of like knew what, I say they, the developers worldwide, kind of like knew what they wanted in the PS2 Xbox era as it got to the end, but they couldn't, I don't think they could realize it until they got to that next generation of the 360 and PS3. I mean, then when that came in there for a wide swath and that became like the baseline, that's where everyone then could do and realize what they wanted to make. And we, this is where we started to get like, was it 2008, which is like, oh my God, it's so great. Is that the super amazing year? It's like 2008 or nine? Like,
well, yeah, 2000, yeah, yeah, it, like the post Bioshock year, when it was just like everything was a massive deal. All these different ideas of how you could do storytelling in games were being blown up. I mean, the industry is not really fully recovered from Bioshock. That idea of asking why, like, why is Sonic getting rings? Why is Mario getting coins? Why are you listening to the narrator? Like, as soon as Bioshock like questioned everything, I feel like that sort of blew everything wide open. But I think in regards to like why the 2000s, because I mostly agree with it, but then I think as the conversation sort of goes on, I tend to like, if I'm thinking of the 2000s, I'm thinking of a much bigger genre diversity across the industry overall, the amount of ideas that were being greenlit with budgets and that were being backed by bigger companies seems to be, there's more of them overall. It seems that across the 2010s, way more formulas got nailed down. And it just became this thing, which we struggle with now, which does bring it back to X Defiant, in regards to that it feels like only a certain amount of titles can get greenlit now. And it feels like there's just an insane amount of homogeny. And like, we talked about it before we started recording, but like, Josh, you mentioned Destiny, and it's like, ever since Destiny's been on the scene, it's like, well, everyone's trying to chase Destiny. And it feels like that's been this massive push across the 2010s, which kind of was always the case in the 2000s as well. You had everybody chasing Gears of War with the cover shooter mold as well. But I tend to like sort of think of budgets, and I think of like the way that, like what Ben Roy said, it felt like more ideas were getting off the ground. I don't know if that's cynical me now, like if I really start like pinning
there's
down genres. Pinning down genres that happened in the 2010s, it feels like, in my head, it feels like more stuff was happening in the 2000s. And even if I'm pointing to something like arcade games, arcade races, arcade sports games, from NBA Street to SSX to the Burnout series or whatever, all that stuff has just gone away so much. It's like, that's one of many sort of side genres that I feel isn't really even represented anymore unless you really go looking for it.
Yeah, I think you're right in that front, definitely. You know, we talk about it all the time if we ever do a podcast, if we ever do news about Rockstar, you know, just how many games, how many different games and different franchises, you know, they put out over the 2000s. Like you said, some of the genres you mentioned there, you know, like those arcade races, you know, spectacle fighters like Devil May Cry, God of War, like they kind of went away. Even fighting games kind of went away for like the longest time. Even now, we only really have, you know, like Mortal Kombat and stuff, you know, Street Fighter, like the biggies of the, like the biggest of the best, quote unquote best, you know, coming out and making a big splash. Whereas in the 2000s, yeah, you're right. You know, there was a whole thing, you know, at the start of the 2010s going into, you know, the middle of that decade about like the double A kind of, you know, video game sphere just falling away, like THQ going away, now they're back. But, you know, we got to a moment where it was either the blockbusters or the indies. Whereas in the 2000s, like you said, we had this middle ground. And I don't want to just put my rose tinted glasses on and say that middle ground was inherently good, because there was so many stinkers and so many bad games just, you know, dotted around shelves that weren't great and are the result of why it went away in the end of the day. But at the same time, yeah, I do agree that in the 2000s we just saw this kind of like explosion. So it's exploded so much, it just spat everywhere. It's this explosion of games, explosion of genres, and you could pick up, you know, so many different titles.
Yeah, it's just mad. Like, I'm looking at like a varied list of stuff in the 2000s. Like, you started off with like Silent Hill 2. I guess Splinter Cell 1 as well came out in 2000.
Was all there, yeah.
Yeah, and then you get towards the end and you're getting things like Metal Gear Solid 4. I mean, you're getting Mass Effect Andromeda, which makes me want to throw up in my mouth, I guess. but yeah, I feel you there, where it felt like we had so much of a variety. Mm-hmm. Because as Scott was saying as well, the costs were a lot less, and we hear everyone now sort of like this come up more and more that if they the big money people are scared to take the big money risk because things you can't. It used to be like you would have like three games that can make up for one game, but like these one of these big games do fall over. Mm-hmm. There's so much of a cost risk and risk. I don't even know I'm saying it right anymore. Sorry, I'm so hot. but then like some of these games, like a big one, like say, I'm just going to say theoretically, like, I don't know, Division 2, that might be around, but that might also be there to prop up other games like Far Cry. They put so much money, but they need it to make these other big profits because other little games might not bring in what they need.
The Christopher Nolan style approach, like one for you, yeah, one for me kind of thing.
It's sort of like... holds them up sort of thing.
Yeah, totally. Well, one thing I was going to like mention, because we touched on kind of like, well, I wanted to bring in that conversation around quality control, because it feels like the overall amount of years it takes to put a game together has gone up drastically. Obviously, budgets have inflated so much as well. So it's even harder to bring these different things together. And there's also the different opinion from the assumed side on the business side of what a consumer wants. So it's, well, we need to aim for a certain level of graphical fidelity if we're going to be AA or AAA, and that extends development, and then different things get scrapped or whatever. There was the whole wing of movie tie-ins that we hardly ever get anymore, and just because of the reality of how long it takes to make a game. But that used to be the case in the 2000s, even if a lot of those games weren't great. Like, you know, for every Lord of the Rings tie-in you had, there was like a Bug's Life or like a really terrible one or whatever.
Oh, you leave
a Bug's Life
alone.
Life out of this.
You watch your words. But those things as well, I think the budgetary constraints, the amount of time it took to make games, allowed companies to put out more stuff. Like, if you just, I'm not going to reel everything off, but comparing Rockstar, for example, the stuff that they put out in the 2000s, like obviously from GTA 3 to Vice City, San Andreas, all the portable titles, and GTA 4, and GTA 4's DLC compared to GTA 5, Red Dead 2, Max Payne 3. Across the 2010s. Like, I guess to roll all that together with the conversation on quality control, it feels like the 2010s became endemic of broken games. Like, there was that whole, you know, the first few years of the generation, it was just like, it didn't feel like they could bring any games together at all. And it was just, it became a thing to expect a game to be broken on launch, which we didn't have in the 2000s. What's your, like, either of your general thoughts, or I guess Josh, your general thoughts on like the, like, now if something's coming out, I expect it to be the worst version of a game. And that definitely wasn't the case in the 2000s.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I just want to quickly jump back to what you said before about, you know, like the explosion of genres kind of like coming to a head at the end of the 2010s. Because I fully agree. I think, you know, when we look at gaming history, you know, if anyone writes like the grand book of gaming history, you know, front to back, mm-hmm. I think we'll look at the end of the 360 console generation and the start of the PS4s as kind of this perhaps butterfly effect moment for the gaming industry, because we could be in such a different position right now had we continued on the path that we were on back then. You know, back then it was very much in this narrow view of what the industry could be. It was like blockbusters are bust. It was people coming out saying horror's dead. No one wants to play horror. Single player games are dead. No one wants to play single player games. We need a multiplayer component for everything, whether it's Dead Space, whether it's Mass Effect, whether it's whatever.
Dead as well.
Was that all PC? That's what I was getting to. Yep, yeah. That was the fourth point. They thought consoles were dead. They thought mobile was the future. This was the path that we were genuinely on, and then the next gen came around, PS4 and Xbox One sold gangbusters, and then we pivoted away from that. Survival horror came back, single player came back, we got more variety in terms of art styles, more variety in terms of genres. So I do think we're on the path back to a potential new golden age now that we've steered away from that. But going on from that to your point about like the quality of the games, that did steer us into this kind of weird place where now that everything was, you know, online, now the patches could be pushed out. I think the threshold for that quality did drop, certainly for a few years. While the video game industry just kind of flexed, you know, what they were able to get away with. I think that's so much of how the game industry operates. It's just them trying to figure out what they can get away with and then, you know, reacting to it, whether that's game quality, whether that's day one patches, whether that's day one DLC, whether that's the season passes, whether that's microtransactions. They've tried all of this stuff. And I feel like they only ever course correct when that goes wrong. So that experimentation is there, just like you said, often it's a bad thing, and it results in kind of things blowing up or getting worse before they get there.
Mm-hmm. Remember Project $10 when EA were literally like, well, you're not going to have part of this game if you bought it back from the shop. You're going to pay us our blood money to get it. And I remember being hit with that when playing Dead Space 3 on Game Pass. Like, the patch didn't download properly, so I couldn't get into it and play it for a bit. It's just like this weird archaic throwback to, like, what were they trying to do to get that extra money of us? Now they're getting that extra $10 out of us. So unless you're buying FIFA, where it's like $100 extra on top, if you want to, like,
no cap for that.
Even have the chance. But I do agree with Josh there, where I feel like it took someone like a Capcom to probably have.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sort of like moderate to sensible budgets with like Resident Evil, and show that we want this sort of thing. And then being the only game in town for a while, and now we potentially get EA coming back with another Dead Space or whatever they're going to reveal to us. I hope at one point they resurrect the Dead Space account, just go, we're not going to be at this EA thing. Everyone's just coming out and telling us that we're not going to be at any event anymore. And then you get to the point where you just, I don't know what's going to be there. Is it just going to be another X Defiant or something like that? Like, I can't wait for them to like neon spray paint on in Dead Space and just
Isaac
like,
oh, in pink armor, yeah, with a like green neon gun. I mean, sure, yeah, at this stage that's what the kids like. But one of the things I was gonna, I guess, I kind of like springboards on from the idea, at least in my mind, of the idea of like inflated budgets and trying to make sure on the publisher side that something is gonna make its money back. It feels like there's like a notable shift in the guard. Like, even on Sony's side, if you look at who's in charge now, obviously Jim Ryan, and the fact that he doesn't really play games, like he just keeps coming money out with man. Statements. Yeah, they're very much a money man, and it feels like a lot of money men are very much in these top positions where they didn't used to be. And it's, you know, you can champion the likes of Shigeru Miyamoto, and Phil Spencer seems to walk the line quite nicely between the two. But someone like a Jim Ryan is more indicative of like the Bobby Kotick or the other sort of money grubbers at the top. And either it's a social media thing, it's the difference in the way that we used to, like, we see all these machinations now, like, you know, 24-hour news networks mean that if something breaks, something leaks, or some financial report, whatever comes out, then we see that stuff immediately, and it's way more nakedly obvious the mistakes that these people are making, or the they're not going down the line of what, you know, we want to see or whatever. Or do you think that is a notable difference? Because in terms of like projects that get greenlit, it feels like everything has to be a bankable property, whether that's a game mechanic, that's a trustable game mechanic. Like something like Ubisoft's X Defiant, there's not a single original idea in there, like, other than we haven't seen a crossover of these characters before, but it's nothing. Like, you
it's
know,
a shooter, yeah, first with Sam Fisher's skin over it. Sam Fisher's been once again sacrificed.
With a
and
punk
we've got
rock
his,
mosh pit energy.
And we've got his goggles now. But like, if you just think back to, like, say, I was saying before, it's like Command and Conquer. Like, they still made a profit, but they didn't make the big money anymore. And as Josh said with Destiny, like, so Destiny does all the big bucks and Destiny brings people in, but then so does a Fortnite. So everything's gone down these two funnels. And then you got, say, like another funnel, like one or two over there. And I think it's for the most part, it seems like just people chasing trends.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, it feels like a miracle if something genuinely original gets off the ground. Like, it always feels like we have this thing in the back of our heads going, like, well, that's a bit of a creative risk. Almost as if we're like imbued with the mentality that the like money
kind of way counters. I wouldn't even go near Avengers because it just seemed like a game made in a lab 7. I mean, everything's focus tested and everything's like that. But when it's so blatantly down to the wire, I mean, you only get a few rare things like the medium, even though it didn't set the world on fire. The medium was nice and different in a way. Yeah, it was just like something new to come out. And it's sad to see X Defiant, and I just get sad about my baby boy, and I just want Josh to cuddle me up now and just make it feel better, really.
I can't, my friend, because all I was going to say is that I think, you know, obviously we're so tuned into all this different stuff. We're tuned into what gets greenlit. We're tuned into the comments from the bosses of all of these studios. But I don't think much has necessarily changed. I think it might have gotten worse and maybe been, exacerbated in some ways. But I mean, you mentioned Bobby Kotick there. I don't believe that man knows what a video game is. I think he's dollar signs when he looks at Call of Duty or when he looks at Blizzard or whatever. And he's been in charge of Activision for a long, long time. It's not like he's a figure that's new, you know what I mean? He's been, you know, ushering Activision in this direction for probably decades now, you know, since easily into the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, we just sort of become more aware of these figures, more scrutinous of what they have to say, especially when they're linked to studios that pitch themselves as gamers or whatever, like, you know, Jim Ryan and PlayStation or whatever. We become more scrutinous of what they're saying, what they're playing, how they act and stuff. But that business mind, it's always been there, man. Like, we talk about things not getting greenlit now, and that's true. But I'd argue that was kind of like, yeah, some things were risky back in the day, but it was still the focus on franchises. It was still, you know, countless Medal of Honors. It was still countless Call of Duties. It was still countless Grand Theft Autos. You know, we got Grand Theft Autos every year, every couple of years and stuff like that. So I feel like that's always there to an extent.
At least I do understand. Though, I guess. Like, that would kind of be my thing. Like, the idea of a Metal Gear Solid being made now feels impossible.
I don't fully agree. I think it's unlikely. I think, you know, obviously it has so much stacked against it, but I still think, you know, we see interesting IP come out, whether that's Ghost of Tsushima, whether that's Days Gone, whether that's Death Stranding. I know they're all PlayStation games, but you can look at, like Ben Roy said, you know, the medium or something, or turn to indie games where there's so much originality, where there's so much creativity. I feel like, you know, yes, you do have to look for them. And Plague Tale, yeah. I'm not saying, you know, I, Josh Brown, could walk into Sony Studios and say, oi, I've got an original game for you, back it, and then they would. Like, I'm not saying it's that easy. I'm acknowledging that it is difficult, but I'm saying that it's probably always been difficult. But if you know where to look for them, I feel like there is still original stuff happening.
I've got a game. I'm going to go into Ubisoft, find Eves, and go, look, you see the Phantom Pain was made in 2015. Just take Sam Fisher's face and put it on that, and you've got something.
Put the goggles on him, or do the same with the Hitman layout or whatever, the formula for that.
Yeah.
It's not that originality overall is dead. We haven't even talked about the indie revolution of the early 2010s. Like, there's obviously a lot of original stuff in there. I guess my point would be that the way Metal Gear came about, where it had like the backing of Konami, Konami as themselves have gone away, but in terms of a notable AAA studio going like, this is this massive deal, big cinematic focus, big memorable characters, this big sort of blockbuster production. One of the only analogs I can make in recent memory is Horizon, where something was like a new IP that arrived fully formed and felt like, you know, it was ready for a mass audience. Like, you know, you have Days Gone, you have Ghost of Tsushima, but I don't feel like they have the blockbuster finish of something like a Metal Gear.
Well, this is the interesting thing. I wonder whether, you know, we pointed Metal Gear, we're all huge Metal Gear fans. Metal Gear obviously changed the industry. It was this huge original IP, but it's also one we love. Like, I would argue that there are blockbusters of that level, originals being made, that we just might not like as much. Like Destiny, I do think is like huge, you know, maybe as influential, but it did change the landscape. Oh. And you've got stuff like Fortnite, then you've got stuff like, you know, other games I was going to mention that I've just completely forgotten. There were definitely some other games that I've just completely forgotten there, but they were mostly like Ubisoft stuff. Watch Dogs was like a brand new.
I'll jump in with that and say I'll defend the Bethesda publishing when we got things like The Evil Within, we got Doom returning, we got Wolfenstein returning, Prey. Gonna say Prey every podcast to get another one. But like, I feel like they were like top tier slash, I guess if we didn't have three tiers, we had five, maybe they're number four because sometimes budgets and all that sort of thing. But I mean, like, from Bethesda publishing, like in a few year, in like a 3 year period, there were so many games come out that I personally enjoyed that I thought were like classic hits and like some of my all time top, like top games. Like, but even I just want to see what Microsoft don't do with that next as well, I guess.
Yeah, one thing that I'm curious about, like going forward, is like, you know, we've like, there was that whole thing about, you know, 2013, the PS4, the Xbox One launched underpowered. It was that whole sort of conversation around, like, even when they launched, they were behind like sort of an average PC or whatever. There's a whole conversation around that, and it eventually led to the PS4 Pro and the Xbox One X and the S and stuff to try and bridge that gap. And the whole selling point being that, you know, like, we're making these for developers, but in reality, it was just allowing developers to make anything that they were trying to make in 2013. Hence, like, the years in between those two consoles coming out were the most broken amount, like the most broken amounts of games we've ever seen. And so now that we're at a point where the PS5 and the Series X, or even the Series S, are very much capable systems and that you can hit 60 FPS and you have this raising of the bar going forward, can we just pick up where we left off in at the very big, like, you know, for the first few years of the 2010s? Because like I said, mentioned before, there was that whole indie revolution across 2012, 2013. You know, the likes of Braid and Gone Home, and obviously it led to things like Firewatch.
Limbo.
Limbo, and like, you know, Last of Us was like a, like, landed at the right time. Bioshock Infinite was 2013. You had all these massive narrative pushing games that also had blockbuster sensibilities about them, and they landed so well. But then we embarked on sort of 5-6 or it's ongoing years of broken AAA games, where it's not unheard of every other week to have something that just arrives in such a knackered state. And I feel like that's the thing that lets you put the rose tinted glasses on for the 2000s, or it definitely does for me. Where I look at, like, oh, well, everything was fine back then, and you didn't get as many sort of half-baked things. But, yeah, what do you guys think of, like, I guess the impact of the indie stuff across the 2010s? Because there wasn't, that level of production wasn't even a thing in the 2000s. It was just games were games. We didn't really think of them from smaller studios.
Totally. I think, you know, one of the, if we were talking about, you know, I would argue that there's so many, like, innovations over the past, you know, decade, over the past 11 years that have pushed the industry forward, the majority of which I might not like, but the one I do kind of want to shout out is not just like the indie thing, but just how accessible video game development for some people has kind of become. You know, you can get people now embracing the ethos of the 90s where it was a bunch of people together making Doom. You can get that in the indie space, you know, with the likes of Unity or other game engines that people can, you know, use and practice their skills. Totally unreal. They can use it and practice their skills. They can maybe put out masterpieces. And in some cases they have. Like, I love that that is happening now. Yes, that has resulted in a lot of bad games as well, but it's also, you know, kind of just made for this really fertile part of the industry where you can get so many interesting experiences that act as a genuine alternative to the AAA space. You know, in the 2000s, yes, there were indie games, of course. Yes, there were people championing indie games, but it was quite rare to find something with the same mainstream pull as a AAA game. Now, though, it is the other side of the coin. It is people, you know, seek this stuff out. You know, people, we now have big publishers like EA doing their EA original things where they're wanting to pump a lot of money into it to mimic the indie vibe because they know there's so much goodwill about there and because they know a lot of people love that style. So yeah, like, I think the indie explosion that continues to this day is just like such a net positive for that kind of entire era. And just there have been so many of, no doubt, our favorite games that have kind of like come from that.
Benro, would you agree with the, I guess, the impact of the indie stuff?
Yeah, and I can just echo what Josh said. And I remember like the indie store on Xbox 360, like where you'd get things like I made a game with zombies in it, or you get a game that vibrates the controller in certain ways for if you want to, you know, practice some stuff.
It was a true afternoon, he says.
Yeah. It was proper, you know, innovative time, I thought, in gaming.
Sure it was,
but things like Limbo, I'll never forget. Like obviously Super Meat Boy, like, broke like through in a major way in Fez and stuff like that. Fez had people communicating with each other, like writing things down on a bit of paper and trying to figure out what was going on. Like you got all these like massive ones that tell some other stories, but then you got ones that I probably don't even know about and I haven't even touched and just like lurking around there somewhere. Like, they come out so fast, and so many of them now, like they've all gone to the Switch because that's where you make your money first, apparently. It's almost like there's two levels of indie now, though, because then we have I can't even think of his name because I'm just melting. The successor of Bastion, because Bastion hit 10 years old today as well. You think of games like that where they're sort of like...
I'm also blanking, but yes, carry on.
No. The one that ever... Hades.
Oh,
Hades,
God.
Hades, oh, Hades, right. Hades. Like,
I was like, the basketball one? That's
yeah, how it's like an evolution of how indies have come. And I just, as I'm just going to ramble on more about how, say, I agree with Josh, indies are great. And it's,
thing is, like, with Hades, that's a really good example of, like, absolutely an indie studio. But, like, that was on top of the Nintendo charts for, like, weeks when it finally launched on Switch, which is really great to see. I feel like as well, the 2010s, like we can refer to the 2000s as this golden age because of the likes of GTA, the likes of Halo, the likes of Metal Gear. But also without the indie revolution in the 2010s, you wouldn't have that maturation period. You wouldn't have the grounding of being able to even do a Last of Us, like or a Last of Us 2 even, or all the games that get called walking simulators, all these different things that added a whole other dimension to video game storytelling that is, I would say, obviously essential. And I think that that does sort of like does elevate the 2010s in quite a considerable way. One thing I was going to mention though, because we were on about before, like the idea of like, is it because we're exposed to this stuff that we think that things are quote unquote worse? And because across the 2000s, we weren't as connected on social media and broadband connections and stuff like that. I wonder, this is pure theory territory, but I wonder if now, because there is so much more marketing data available, that it allows the top tier companies to just scour that stuff and focus test everything to death. And something like an X Defiant is very much the product of that. Where you can, and there's so many titles like that, like an Anthem or whatever, like you just look at all those squad shooters where it's like no team of developers with money behind them left in a room by themselves are going to come up with something that is such an identical ripoff. But I feel like the amount of data that is available only emboldens the number crunches at the top to go, well, that's not going to work because clearly that works. We should do that. And it leads to things like an X Defiant. That for me would be a notable quantifiable difference between the way that we used to interact with data across the 2000s to the 2010s.
I agree, but I also would argue again.
Please
not
do.
Not against your point, but also just saying that is, I think, an exacerbation of stuff that started in the 2000s. Because, you know, like, I still think, you know, the internet was still around in the 2000s. Yes, it's not as widespread. Yes, it's not. So it's intrinsically tied to, you know, the video game production as it is now. But at the same time, you know, marketing's been, like, you know, using focus-tested things, like, using this data for decades and decades, whether it's in video games, whether it's in movies and stuff. And yes, they do have easier access, perhaps, to that stuff now. But I still think they were ticking those boxes back in the day. You know, look at how many modern military games that used perks came onto the market after... Call of Duty. Like, look how many people, like you said, with Gears of War, ripped off not only the cover system, but the aesthetic, you know, like gray and brown aesthetic. You look at Mass Effect 3 compared to Mass Effect 2, for instance, and that's very, Mass Effect 2 compared to Mass Effect 1, sorry. And that's very much being like, okay, well, what's the trend? I love Mass Effect 2, but you can tell that its art style has changed to fit how video games were supposed to look at the time, in the same way that I think movies now have changed their aesthetics to look like the market leader, which in this case is MCU movies. Yep. You know, everything's kind of a bit muted, a bit gray, a bit realistic, quote unquote. So I feel like the data has always been there, is the only thing I'm trying to say.
No, totally. Yeah, there's obviously always been some data there. I guess I'm talking about en masse, like algorithmic, the amount of like data that a social media account has on you that fundamentally wasn't there before 2007 or whatever. The way that YouTube has changed and the way that, like, you know, you can look at a viewer's habits and you can look at someone's habits and gear towards that en masse. But yeah, Ben Roy, what do you think of that potential conversation point around stat tracking, data tracking being the thing that is underlying a lot of makeshift trends in the gaming industry?
I think it's different. Like, I think you're both hitting it on the head in a certain way, like where we got like a Bioshock 2 and it was just like, do a Bioshock 2, don't care, just do a Bioshock 2 sort of thing. And how we get all these games now where it's like, what can we throw up and like put in a bucket and then that comes out and it's X-Defiant. Sorry anyone that's worked hard on that. I'm sure it's a great game. But
the gameplay does look great.
I'm just a random person, really random idiot in a hot box just talking about just crapping on someone's work that they've been working on for like 20 years probably in their life. But I think there's merit to what you're saying, Scott, because obviously these stores have been around forever and they've probably got like they probably can track where our cursors go in the store at this point. And well, they've had that for
on the website before. You literally can.
They've had that since like 360 and PS3. So they and Steam have had that since Gabe Newell decided he was become Gabe Newell the White, and now that's how you get the Steam Deck. So it all just comes through to the numbers at the end of the day. And I think you're both right, and I think it's been done different ways. But now I think some of us are a bit more like, is this more of a formula? Because some of the things that come out aren't really our taste.
And I'm like obviously able to like divorce those things, but I think all of it's like fascinating. None of this is to draw any conclusions either. We should round out on just gut check answering the question, like to, I guess, Josh first. Do you think the 2000s were a golden age in gaming?
I think without going on a huge tangent, I think it was a continuation of a golden age, but not the golden age in and of itself. I think it was very much a decade of transition as much as it was of pioneering and establishing things.
The thing is, like, the thing that Benroy said at the very beginning, and you've like backed it up by some of the examples you've given too, and just thinking about it, I actually think it's exactly what Benroy said. Like, it's the period, if you're going to knock it down to a 10-year chunk, it is 2005 to 2015, more than it's 2000 to 2010 or 2009. That would be my shout anyway. Benroy, what would your answer be to the 2000s being a game?
Well, someone said at the beginning of the podcast, it's 2005 to 2015.
They might have done, yeah.
I'm going to leave them that, but no. I think it was definitely a good decade. I mean, we were coming out of the Attitude Era and we were trying to grow up and not be, as, you know, like in each other's face anymore and penis jokes. we're getting older.
That's your divider for the 2000s. Penis jokes, isn't it?
Suck it, everyone. Break it down. I'm going to say 2005, 2015, and I'm going to set this pod on fire.
Fair enough. I think we should pass it over to the comments, or you can come find us on social media, depending on what your thoughts are on the 2000s being the golden age for gaming, or whether or not you think the 2010s is potentially better. For now, though, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tailford, joined by Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
And Benroy Turner.
Ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba. Goodbye.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.